Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Christian nationalism involves the claim that the foundation of our government is bound up with a reactionary understanding of a particular religion. So it's an anti-democratic political ideology. It ties the idea of America to specific religion and cultural identities. So it's not just an ideology, it's also a device for mobilizing people to vote for the hyper-conservative political candidates that the movement favors, and it's a means of concentrating power in the hands of a new elite.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, much has been made of the religious right's power in American politics, especially since the nomination by President Donald Trump of Amy Coney Barrett to fill the seat of the recently deceased Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the Supreme Court. Concerns have been raised that Barrett, along with other figures associated with the Trump administration, such as Attorney General Bill Barr, are hyper-conservative and driven by extreme religious convictions that would have ramifications for American democracy. Joining us on this edition of the program is Catherine Stewart, a journalist and author of the book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. How did the religious right, and in particular Christian nationalists, ascend to such staggering levels of political power in the United States? Catherine joins us to answer that question and many others. And in case you're wondering or saying to yourself, oh, this just sounds like anti-Christian bigotry, think again. In fact, I would argue that people like Catherine are very much in favor of true religious liberty, as she will point out in the following conversation. And with that being said, let's get right to it with Catherine Stewart, author of The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. Welcome to Parallax Views, Catherine Stewart, author of The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. How are you doing today, Catherine?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Pretty good.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Catherine, I have to ask you, I was telling someone that I was doing yet another interview about the religious right in America and some of the dangers they pose. And they said to me something very interesting. Because I just had Ann Nelson on a while back, and she helped get you on. And they said to me, why do you do these interviews about the religious right? Why are you covering this? It seems like that's an era that's behind us now. You know, that's like the George W. Bush administration and that, You know, that was when the Christian nationalists were strong. Who cares about now? What would you say to people who think that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, let's start with the 2016.
Do you get that at all, by the way, from some people, that it's a dying thing?
I don't, but I see that kind of, I don't see that anymore that often, but I heard that type of sentiment expressed until rather recently. But I think what the 2016 election made clear is that this is not only not a movement that's going away, but it's got more political power than ever before and more political access. I mean, let's start with the 2016 election. Trump got elected by making a deal with Christian nationalists, with the religious right, many people define as Christian nationalists because they tied the idea of America to specific religious and cultural identities. So he got elected by making a deal with them. They've got all the sort of, you know, have invested for decades in all of the features of modern campaign infrastructure. It's like a kind of a machine. So he made a deal with the leaders and they put the machinery to work on his behalf. And result, he won a higher share of their vote than any of his Republican predecessors. And he has since worked overtime to repay them for their loyalty by promising them, fulfilling his promises to appoint judges favorable to their interests, by promoting their so-called religious freedom agenda, and by offering them a steady flow of federal dollars for the initiatives that they want to have funded, and indeed to steady stream of money to go to many of the conservative religious organizations and churches that have tried for a long time to claim a share of public money and have been in many instances prevented from doing so until the Trump administration. I think, you know, he obviously has appointed judges favorable to their interests, and they in turn have elevated his presidency to the level of biblical prophecy. I think if Bush, for instance, was on a scale of like a theocracy scale, like a maybe a 4, Trump is like an 8 or a 9. Another fundamental change, I think, in the Trump era has been within the movement itself. I think during the Bush years, Dominionism, that is the more explicitly theocratic side of the Christian right, was considered quite marginal and so taboo that Bush's speechwriter, Michael Gerson, sneered. He said, this is a movement that could fit into a phone booth. But, you know, now Gerson is cringing on the sidelines. And, you know, these never Trumpers are really alarmed at what the Trump administration has become. While Dominionism is openly discussed and championed among this cohort.
Now, I guess this leads into my next question, because a lot of people that I know that are naysayers about the issue of the religious right, or not naysayers, but that think it's a dying thing, their answer would be, well, demographics. You know, this will be over like 2030, 2040, 2050, just a few decades from now, because they're hemorrhaging numbers, don't you know? You know, there's not, evangelicals are losing the young people. So how would you respond to that? And you have a good answer to this, actually, I think. So,
well, you know, in a country where 40 to 50% of people don't turn out to vote, and an additional number of Americans have their vote disenfranchised through race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression, it doesn't take a majority of the country to win elections. All it takes is a really committed minority, an organized minority. So the religious right is in fact a minority of our population, but they have disproportionate political power and punch above their political weight precisely because they are so organized and networked. And I think one way to get a handle on the numbers is to look at the work of somebody like the evangelical pollster George Barna. He is sort of deeply enmeshed in the machinery of the movement. And he noted in this wonderful book he wrote, it's called The Day Christians Changed America. It's about the election of Trump. He said the most committed religious right voters, he calls them SAGE cons. It's an acronym that stands for Spiritually Active, Governance Engaged Conservatives. He said they they are disproportionately involved in the political process and vote in extremely high numbers. So they're just 10% of the population, according to Barna. But 91% turned out to vote in 2016. 91%. And 93% of those cast their vote for Trump. So you see, he puts the number of sage cons, roughly like 25 million, from like a political voting perspective, that might be a little bit on the low side. We can look at the work of Whitehead and Perry, who wrote this wonderful book called Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States. And they analyzed data from the Baylor religion survey. And they said that about 20 to 25% of voters, what they call ambassadors for Christian nationalism. And that is they're the ones who are more likely to vote, talk to their neighbors about voting, organize their church congregations to vote along with the help of their sort of right-leaning pastors, tell people they need to vote their so-called biblical values, and they punch above their weight in terms of their voter engagement, and because they vote in disproportionate numbers.
So I want to back up a second because, I have family members that listen to this show, and sometimes I look for their feedback, and they'll say to me, "Oh, JG, you went too fast for me. I'm not as political as you are. I don't even know what the terms mean. What is Christian nationalism?" That's what they would say to me. So maybe you can define terms a little bit. What is Christian nationalism and the larger agenda of the religious right?
Sure. Christian nationalism involves the claim that the foundation of our government is bound up with a reactionary understanding of a particular religion. So it's an anti-democratic political ideology. It ties the idea of America to specific religion and cultural identities. So it's not just an ideology, it's also a device for mobilizing people to vote for the hyper-conservative political candidates that the movement favors, and it's a means of concentrating power in the hands of a new elite. Other people use other terms to describe this movement, including theocracy, dominionism, religious right, and Christian right, and other terms. I use those terms too, where appropriate, but I use the term religious nationalism in the subtitle of my book because it reflects the fact that this is a political movement, and it also makes clear its similarities with other forms of religious nationalism around the world. So when you see leaders like Putin in Russia, or Erdogan in Turkey, or Modi in India, or Duda now in Poland, Orban in Hungary, when you see these leaders binding themselves tightly to religious ultra-conservatives in their own countries in order to consolidate a more authoritarian form of political power, I think we rightly recognize that as forms of religious nationalism. There are obviously different features specific to different countries, but in fact, it's the use of religion to create a sort of national identity. And that's what we're seeing today with Trump's alliances, very public alliances with some of our own religious hyper-conservatives. Now, there's a subsection of his supporters that refer to him as a king. They call him a King Cyrus or a King David, a sort of biblical king, imperfect ruler through whom God chose to enact his will. So here's the thing about kings. They are not kings of democracies. They are the law unto themselves. They're not, and this makes clear the fact that this is not, it's an anti-democratic movement. It doesn't believe in representative government or the idea of equality for all. I think that, people support Trump for a number of reasons, but I think for some section of his supporters, he actually appeals to their authoritarian impulses. And that's why you get a lot of the sort of king talk. I think people think, well, the religious right, how could they possibly support a guy who sleeps with them, pays women to have sex with him and, he lies and he's, I don't even know where to begin. He's like the most patently, cheats people out of money that they're owed in his own private business dealings. You just can't even, the list is so long, I don't know, even know where to start. He would seem to represent every attribute that a person who identifies as Christian would not want to associate themselves with. And I think some people say, well, you know, they're in it for the judges. You know, they're in it because he's going to put in judges that are going to ban abortion, or, you know, they're going to, he's going to promote economic policies that they think are favorable to their pocketbooks. But I think there's something more than that.
I think they're attracted to strongmen. I don't know if that's the direction you were going in.
Exactly. It's an attraction to a strongman. I mean, you know, this is how you build an authoritarian movement. You don't build it through consensus and compromise and fair representation and accordance with the law. You build it by compelling everyone to adhere to extreme and irrational positions and by insisting that they declare their unwavering loyalty to an extreme and irrational leader.
Now, how did you get on this beat, so to speak?
Wow.
I believe it starts with a very strange group, I think called the Good News Club.
Yeah. I really got into this beat by following the facts, but it started on the playgrounds of Santa Barbara, California. And I was living there with my husband and our two kids. I had a baby boy and a six-year-old girl in either kindergarten or first grade. And I learned through the moms at our school that a Good News Club was coming to our town and was going to set up shop inside our public school. So I was a little confused. I was a bit naive. You know, I thought that separation of church and state meant that you couldn't have, you know, fundamentalist clubs operating inside public schools that were trying to persuade very little kids that the religion that was inside their school was endorsed by the school. But, you know, I started, you know, I also, you know, I looked into the group. At first I thought, well, they describe themselves as non-denominational. I was really naive. I thought non-denominational meant non-sectarian. So I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, I took a Bible class when I was in public school as a kid, but it was from a truly non-sectarian standpoint. I think you can teach about the Bible and about religion in public schools from a truly non-sectarian standpoint in comparative religions or as, you know, history or literature. But I started to look into what the Good News Club was really all about, and I became a little more alarmed. I realized that the group was establishing clubs in other public elementary schools. And when they would establish their clubs, kids attending the club would insist that they would like target their peers for what I could only describe as faith-based bullying and bigotry. And they would say, you're going to go to hell without Jesus. And I know it's true because they taught it to me in school. And they don't teach things in school that aren't true. Look, I'm a big free speech supporter, and I don't have a problem with kids talking about their religion at school, but I do have a problem with kids thinking that their public school endorses a particular religious viewpoint and then using that misinformation to target their peers for faith-based bullying and bigotry. Like, anyone who's had little kids or has ever worked with them knows that a child at that age, 5, 6, 7 years old, cannot make a distinction between activity that's in their school and one that's sponsored by their school. They think if it's in their public school, it must be what their school wants them to believe.
So it sounds like the Good News Club. I mean, if these kids are going around being taught that, oh, you're going to go to hell if you don't, you know, do this, this, and this.
Oh, yeah.
I'm assuming these clubs sort of terrorize these children into submission. And then I don't know, how does a parent deal with that? Because if I'm a parent, I'm going to end up having a kid that goes to one of these Good News Club things, and they're going to come home saying, Mommy, Daddy, we're going to go to hell if we don't become Christians and go to church more.
Well, it's really astonishing. There's a 5-year curriculum cycle in these Good News Clubs, and an independent observer who was a sort of himself, he'd been to Good News Clubs as a child. He analyzed their 5-year curriculum cycle a few years ago, and he found thousands of references to obedience, hell, And only two or three glancing references to the golden rule or the royal law, which is loving your neighbor as yourself. So, you know, it's important to note that it's a very particular fundamentalist form of evangelical Christianity. We all know that evangelicalism is diverse, like every other religious expression in our beautifully, you know, diverse society. But this represents one particular extreme form. And, you know, again, it's not the form of the faith that's being taught in the public school, although I do think it's very interesting to note that the groups that are trying to force their way in public schools tend to be from the conservative end of the evangelical spectrum. It's like you don't see United Methodists like forcing their programs in the public schools, or Episcopalians, or most of the mainline denominations, for instance. But, or on balance, Catholics for that matter. It's an after school club and parents have to sign their permission. But a lot of the, even though it's after school, a child cannot make a distinction between activity that's happening on school grounds and one that's, you know, sponsored by an outside group. Is it endorsed by the school? Like, public schools have a cloak of authority in the minds of young children, especially. And Good News Clubs only target children at the elementary level. So these clubs are taught by adults and they're on school grounds. Sometimes they're taught by adults who are associated with the schools, like their teachers, like if a kindergarten teacher, and I've heard from hundreds of parents who say this is happening, that kindergarten teacher happens to be attending a church that's sponsoring a Good News Club. And then she's teaching the class. And at the end of the day, she does a roll call. Okay, who's attending the Good News Clubs? And kids want to, you know, be favored by their teachers. But regardless, it's on public school grounds. Now, let's remember, public schools, you're not allowed to do politicking. You know, you can't have in a public elementary school the New York Democrats meeting every week, or Mobile Alabama Republicans meeting every week on public school property. Public schools exclude political organizing and gatherings on public school grounds because this is public space. It's funded by the common taxpayer fund. It's supposed to be common to all. And yet when these religious clubs want to, this particular religious club aimed to establish itself in public schools, you know, they sort of found a way to work around those types of restrictions. They argued that exclusion was a violation of their free speech rights.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works. You have to admit, these sort of religious right groups are very clever in a lot of ways, because, you know, they'll say, we believe in religious liberty, when really that's, you know, they don't, they're only interested in their sort of rights as Christians. You know, there's issues like tax exempt status of churches as well.
Yeah.
They play a very clever game with a lot of these things.
It's true. I mean, true religious liberty is the freedom of thought, conscience and worship. But in the hands of Christian nationalists, the term has come to mean something like its opposite. It's come to be an Orwellian term that means religious privilege. And it's Orwellian in two ways. First, it's become the idea that conservative Christians should be permitted to discriminate against LGBT people and others whose characteristics or very being offends their so-called sincerely held religious beliefs. This privileges certain religious views over others. So if your commitment to equality and equal treatment under the law is rooted in your own sincerely held religious beliefs, there is no liberty in this type of religious liberty for you. And second, the calls for religious freedom that characterize so much of the activism today are also a bid for public money. They really want to increase the flow of public money in their direction. So we have to remember that religious organizations already get public money through tax credits, deductions, grants, vouchers, and other means. They have substantial benefits that other both for-profit and non-religious nonprofits simply don't have. But movement leaders really want to substantially increase that flow of funds. And that's really obvious, I have to say, in the field of public education, where religiously motivated voucher activists are arguing that the failure to fund religious schools on the same basis as public schools is a violation of their religious liberty. Well, this is, you know, effectively eviscerates the Establishment Clause, the separation of church and state, which is, you know, if you read the works of our founders, they were very explicit. They didn't think, you know, public, private, religious organizations are, we should all have freedom of worship. That's really important. And, you know, we're all free to do that, but we shouldn't expect the taxpayer to fund churches. And that's essentially what the religious right is after.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I wanted to ask about, you know, I think a lot of Christian nationalists would have an answer to you on that too. They would say, no. It's a Christian nation. I guess I'm interested in understanding, how did they build up what, you know, Sidney Blumenthal, he used to work for the Clinton administration. He's called it a sort of counter-establishment that the right in America has made. I would call it like a counter narrative, a parallel universe, a sort of alternative facts. Yeah. How did they build this up?
Well, they built it partly through the work of these pseudo historians like David Barton, who has this incredible.
I'm very familiar. Yes.
Oh yeah, that's how they do it. And they, you know, I call him the Where's Waldo of the Christian nationalist movement, because he sits on the boards of so many of its initiatives. His work has been so heavily discredited by many Christian professors at evangelical colleges. One of his books was voted like the least credible book of history on the History News Network. I mean, his work has been debunked over and over and over again. But, you know, the movement stands behind him because this sort of false narrative of America's allegedly Christian founding is so valuable to them that they won't discard it simply because it's been proven to not be true over and over again. And I mean, we have to note that this hits home that this is not just a stance in the so-called culture wars. So, you know, I think terms like religious right or Christian right, when you're talking about members of the Christian right and Christian nationalist movement, you're often talking about the same people, but there's a different sort of implication in this type of terminology. Christian right like almost implies that this is sort of a culture war. You know, but this is a political movement. And I think the term Christian nationalism gets at that harder. And you can see that it's a political movement when you look at the range of policy positions promoted by the movement. So let's go back to David Barton. Not only does he assert that America is a so-called Christian nation, he's been known to make up quotes from our founders, but he also argues that the Bible and God oppose progressive income taxes, capital gains taxes, and minimum wage laws. You know, the religious right has for a very long time allied itself with sort of libertarian far-right economic wing of the Republican Party. And I think that that's an underappreciated aspect of the movement. So Barton wrote an essay titled The Bible, Slavery, and America's Founders. And here's what he wrote. He wrote that different forms of slavery have replaced the more obvious system of past centuries. And then he said, the state has assumed the role of master for many, providing aid and assistance, and with it more and more control to those unable to provide for themselves. The only solution to slavery is the liberty of the gospel. So Barton is casting forms of government aid, things like job training and healthcare and food assistance or tuition assistance for students. He's casting this as a form of slavery. I mean, it's so wrong on so many levels, but it does hit home sort of the fact that they're using this sort of idea of America as a so-called Christian nation, this fake history, also to say that they know what God would have thought about progressive income taxes and the minimum wage. I mean, it's really hits home the fact that this is a broader political movement, and thereafter, not just ending abortion and say, you know, defense of what they consider the traditional family, but thereafter certain types of tax policies that privilege the rich. After certain features in our foreign policy, they have a foreign policy agenda and a very broad ranging domestic policy agenda.
It's interesting you mentioned, I want to get back to that. I want to delve into how much of this is, you know, really religious and how much of it is really political. But first I wanted to ask, you mentioned the culture war aspect, and I hear a lot of sort of far right or Christian nationalist people, if you read their works, talk about the culture war. And I've noticed over the years when reading, you know, websites like WorldNet Daily, which has a lot of these like right wing figures, they seem to go with this line that this is the worst time to be Christian in all of America.
Oh, it's you so know? Apocalyptic. The language is like everything that they have more disproportionate political power. They essentially have more rights than the rest of us because it's their initiatives alone that are in the public schools. And they, you know, have all these policies enshrined into the law that actually privilege a sort of conservative religious perspective. And yet anything that fails to affirm them is cast as somehow hostile to them. But that person,
that's what I don't understand. Like we have, they still have tax exempt status. It doesn't make any sense.
It's essential to building their base. How do you build a unified, you know, how to unify a radical core? You unify it around a kind of persecution narrative. So it's all part of getting everybody on board and on the same page. You know, it's interesting. Did you watch the Republican National Convention this year?
Yes.
It was worth watching. So you remember that Donald Trump Jr. said, this election is a choice between church, school, and work, and looting and marauding, as though there's nothing in between. So they're casting this as an apocalyptic choice between absolute good and absolute evil. And those of us who want to go to church, work, and school and raise our children in peace, who disagree with the politics of conquest and division that Trump represents, are completely cut out of the conversation. It's ridiculous. But this is what they do. They, you know, they've been doing this for years. It reminds me, can we go back some, you know, to some time in history, to the pro-slavery theologians? Let's talk about somebody like Robert Louis Dabney or James Henley Thornwell. These were pro-slavery theologians that defended the institution of slavery, and they were very empowered within their church denominations. And they cast, I'm going to read you a quote, if you don't mind, just brings to mind this quote from James Henley Thornwell. He was a, you know, very prominent leader of the Southern Presbyterian Church. He said, the party's talking about abolition. Now, there were abolitionist theologians, but they tended to be poor and not as well resourced and not as well sort of empowered as these representatives of the major denominations, which had on balance made their peace with slavery and some actively promoted it. So James Henley Thornwell said, the parties in this conflict are not merely abolitionists and slaveholders. They're atheist, socialist, communists on the one side, and friends of order and regulated freedom on the other. So here's he's casting this conflict between abolitionists and pro-slavery theologians as a conflict between chaos and communism and atheism and friends of regulated freedom and order. And it's that kind of apocalyptic framing. There's like a kind of a through line through our history. Those who promote a sort of idea of a very strict biblical liberalism, an abject submission to authority, the idea of hierarchies as rooted in their interpretation of the Bible, have often cast the choice between one of, you know, their vision, which is absolute good, and the rest of us who are just demonized as and considered absolute evil. I mean, you can see this in the works of the mid-century theologian Roussas, John Rush Denis. You can see this in the works of so many leaders today. You can even see it in the words of people like Bill Barr, who, you know, has written over time about, blaming secularists for ransacking out there, ransacking everything that's good and holy in our society and casting this sort of decision, what kind of, you know, is our country going to be ruled by sort of the kind of theocratic elite and governed by religious leaders in concert with their favorable politicians, or, you know, is it going to go to hell?
Well, it's good that you brought up Bill Barr, because something I always hear is people on the center, the left, or on the liberal end of things, whatever you want to call it, this sort of movement that is against where Trump is taking us, and they'll say, "Oh, how could they vote for Trump? How could a Christian vote for Trump? He doesn't even act Christian." What's interesting is, I think a lot of these evangelicals would agree. I don't think they care if he acts very Christian. I mean, Bill Barr, I've covered how he's given speeches to religious groups talking about the unitary executive, this idea of centralization of power into the hands of the president. Maybe explain, is this really about religion or is this about, well, your title, worshiping power?
It's about, I think it's about both. I mean, he has embraced wholesale, you know, the religious liberty rhetoric of today's religious right. But he has a long history of supporting this kind of, you know, this specious idea of religious liberty. At Notre Dame, he compared alleged violations of religious liberty with Roman emperors forcing Christian subjects to partake in pagan sacrifices. And he said, you know, the law is being used as a battering ram to break down traditional moral values and to establish moral relativism as a new orthodoxy. You know, this is the kind of language he's been seen as, you know, he's been promoting these ideas for a very long time. He wrote a 1995 article in which he said, we live in an increasingly secular militant age. And he was, his concern at that time, he was really worried that the universities were going to treat gay activist groups like any other student group. He found this idea intolerable. So over the years, he's sort of uttered these types of statements. He says that the record of the wreckage of the family, drug abuse, all of this stems from a loss of the strict interpretation of the Christian religion, in his view. So, you know, he casts those who fail to conform to his idea of what religion looks like as evildoers. And he's also said things like the Judeo-Christian moral standards are the ultimate utilitarian rules for human conduct. Well, so much for the Constitution, so much for the reasonable interpretation, judicial precedents, so much for the idea of equality in an irreducibly pluralistic society, so much of the idea, so much for the idea of true religious liberty, or the diversity of interpretation of religion within even just the Christian faith alone.
I guess the reason I ask about the religious aspect is because, so I grew up and would still consider myself in some ways, like at least culturally Catholic. So I'm curious, this isn't, I think, from reading your book, an attack on religion or people that believe in a faith at all for you. Maybe you could elaborate on, you can see where I'm going with this.
Nothing could be further from the truth. I think it's really hard to write about the political aspects of different religious groups or the weaponization of religion for political purposes without people thinking it's an attack on religion, but it's not. There is a difference. And I think sometimes if we look to other countries where we can see how obvious this is when, in a way, what the religious right has done is reduce all of politics to religion and all of religion in a way to the question of abortion. You know, so they get people to vote on these single issues and they cast any deviation. And we have to remember, just even in terms of the abortion issue, when Roe v. Wade was passed, most Protestant Republicans supported it. It was really considered a Catholic issue, but it also didn't divide Republicans from Democrats. It was often cast within the context of a larger continuation of care for the poor, and things like that. So the question of abortion, if you're voting to end abortion at that moment, or didn't want to, or were hoping to end or reduce the number of abortions, you weren't also voting to end aid to the poor. In many cases, you might, want to support economic policies that actually aided families. But what the religious nationalists have done is that they have, over time, they unified a kind of hyper-conservative counter-revolution around the issue of abortion for them as a way of getting conservative Catholics and conservative Protestants on board and having a better way to kind of control people's vote. So they, when you vote to end abortion, for instance, like a pro-life vote is, when they use the term, it's not just about abortion. It's about like a whole, like a you know, like a whole agenda of economic policies as well as domestic policies. And it's not just really about abortion. I mean, it's really interesting because I think that when many Trump supporters or, you know, people who are very loosely Christian nationalist, as Whitehead and Perry would say, they would say they're Christian nationalists in a loose way. When they're voting to end abortion or when they, you know, say things like, you know, they think America's founded as a Christian nation, they're not really aiming for major changes in the way our government is run. They're really saying something about their identity and what they value in themselves. But for the leaders of the movement, you know, we're talking to the heads of the right-wing policy groups, the legal advocacy groups, the media platforms, the data initiatives, and all of them, the think tanks and all of those groups. I mean, they're after a larger political vision that involves a lot more power for themselves and their allies and their plutocrat, you know, policies that benefit their plutocratic funders. And they're also looking for a time when they can rely on a steady source of public funding for their initiatives.
You know, it's interesting. I just thought of this. I've noticed in the past, I don't know, decade or so, that there's this like rising sort of element of the Black community that is like hyper conservative and will promote these documentaries about Margaret Sanger and you know, Planned Parenthood, and it's a genocide against Black America. I'm bringing this up because do the Christian nationalists fund stuff like that? Do they try to get involved in non-white communities? Because I get the impression,
absolutely. You know, it's absolutely, you know, the racial dynamics of the movement are complex. I think that the movement, for many of the white people in the movement, it's, you know, it's an implicitly white movement in that it ties the idea of America to specific religious and racial identities. But leaders of the movement know that the future, that, you know, they can read the demographic data as well as you and I can, and they know the future of the movement cannot be ethnically homogenous. So they've actually made an effort in recent years to reach out to conservative-leaning pastors of color in order to, you know, capture some subsection of their votes. And they've also tried to sort of, you know, aim certain parts of the culture war at, you know, conservative-leaning Black voters and Latino voters. But, you know, there's an irony there that they're, you know, engaging these conservative-leaning pastors and their congregations to fight the culture wars that drive support for a political party that has made race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression a strategic imperative. So, you know, over the past 10 years, as I've been researching this movement, I go to innumerable, you know, religious right conferences and gatherings and marches for life and, you know, evangelicals for life conferences and things like that. And they have often made an effort, not always, but in many instances, they make an effort to elevate voices of color in these initiatives in order to sort of appeal to that subsection of voters. You know, I went to this pro-life conference recently. It was very multiracial. They said it was like non-sectarian, but it was sectarian because they wouldn't talk about birth control. They said, oh, that's a religious issue for a lot of people, so we're not going to talk about birth control. I'm like, really? You want to prohibit unintended pregnancies? Do you think you might want to talk about that? But anyway, where was I going for this? Oh, yeah. And there was a speaker there who just said, you know, we should create single issue voters. You should all be single issue voters. No matter, no issue matters more than this issue. If you can get people to vote on a single issue, you can control their vote.
I wanted to get into that more. You've talked to the strategists. You've seen them up close and personal. What has your experience been with that? Do they know who you are? And maybe get into the details there.
I mean, for me, it's like, I love the work I do. I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it. I think it's fascinating. I've always been really interested in religion and the diversity and the sort of beautiful mosaic of religions that we have in our country. I think it'd be a nicer world, frankly, if we could just allow one another to, worship freely without regard to politics. You know, but we're not living in that world at the time because this is a movement that sort of weaponized religion for political purposes. So in terms of like interviewing the leaders, I've had good relations with some of them. I mean, I tend to, you know, go, you know, I've had some leaders invite me to things, to events, even knowing that I'm an opposition journalist.
I wanted to add real quick, the leadership can be interesting to me sometimes because I think sometimes they're very upfront about what they believe and what they want to do politically in a way that you wouldn't expect them to.
Well, here's the thing. They're ignored by a lot of the mainstream media. It's always shocking to me how few people there are, how few journalists there are at the Values Voters Conference. I'm like, I remember the one, like the, you know, the one leading up to Trump's election, and I went to a Road to Majority conference, all of these right-wing conferences where the leadership of the movement is gathering, and they're talking about things like, you know, Ralph Reed is saying, we're going to devote $40 million to this election cycle, and we're going to, you know, place, you know, X million number phone calls and texts, and if people haven't voted by 4 o'clock, we're going to drive to their house. And I'm like, there's so much they've invested for all of these features of, you know, modern political campaigns for decades. This is how the right gets out their vote, through religion. And it's always shocking to me that people don't talk about the political aspects of religion more, that more people don't focus on that, because, you know, they'll always like find a diner in Ohio and talk to some guy. It's like, you're missing the bigger picture. You're missing the infrastructure. You're missing the data initiatives that the right is using to turn out the vote. And that's just kind of surprising to me. So I think one of the reasons why some of the leadership is willing to talk is because I recognize their work. I see what they've done. It's like people do a lot of hard work. They want to show it. They want it to be recognized. Now, I'm an opposition journalist. I pull no punches. I'm, you know, very, I don't make stuff up. You know, everything's very carefully fact-checked. If I'm writing a piece for the Times and I write that, you know, we met at a church that was on the bank of a lake, they'll say, was it a lake? Or was it an estuary? Or was it really a river? Or was it a pond? Like, we really have, like, every detail is really carefully parsed, and, you know, I have to have links for everything. But, you know, I'm very clear that I think this is a movement that is destroying our democracy, that has divided our nation as never before, and is deeply, just deeply anti-democratic.
I was going to say, in regards to that leadership and, you know, maybe being ignored by the mainstream, how they feel that they're ignored by the mainstream, I think there's truth to that. It's really interesting. When I was younger, I sort of found a lot of this like evangelical holy roller stuff to be like kind of, you know, mockable. You know, I found unintentional comedy in it, right? Mm-hmm. Like I would see stuff like there was a book, and I thought it was so crazy when I found it as a teenager. It was called The Pink Swastika by Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams. I don't know if you've heard of this book.
I have.
Yeah, but I thought it was like, I'm like, no one could actually believe this. It's total fringe insanity. And then the guy that wrote it is like a gubernatorial candidate.
I know. I'm sorry, what's the last thing you said?
Oh, I was saying the guy who co-wrote it was a gubernatorial candidate. Right. Yeah, Scott Lively. I'm thinking to myself, you know, as much as we may think this is funny and dumb and like no one actually believes this, they do have followers, and they do sort of work beneath the radar of the mainstream. People like Scott Lively. Yeah.
I think we should listen to them and, you know, take them at their word and, you know, pay attention, you know, to what they're saying. They mean it. It's not like, you know, people ask me, is this a conspiracy? No, of course it's not. Conspiracies happen under the cover of darkness with unnamed actors. You know, it's not that they're hiding. It's that we're not listening.
So, In regards to the leadership, and then we'll start wrapping up because I know you have to go. But I wanted to ask about a figure you mentioned earlier, Rush Dooney.
Oh yeah.
Who is that? Because to me, some of the stuff I've read by him is just really scary and out there.
It's amazing. People, you know, he's one of these, thinkers. Okay, so Rusas John Rushdoony advocated a return to biblical law in America. Much of the current crop of Christian nationalists are kind of descended from him, among many other people. He was a very influential theologian although of course not the only influential theologian. The main thing to know about him, he was intensely hostile to the principle of equality. He endorsed a very austere biblical literalism and, you know, rigid hierarchies, which he said were ordained by God. So in his view, the 14th Amendment, which includes a guarantee that all citizens receive equal treatment under the law, he said this began the court's recession from its conception of America as a Christian country. See, he too promoted that Christian nation narrative. And he saw it as his job to rescue America from godless secularism. His theology included also, like many Christian nationalists today, an opposition to government assistance to the poor, to public education. And he cast social welfare programs as slavery to the state. So remember I mentioned David Barton? When he cast social welfare problems programs as slavery to the state, he actually cited Rush Dooney in that paper extensively. So when David Barton is writing a paper about the Bible slavery and America's founders, there are so many theologians. He could have cited thousands of theologians who have interpreted the issue of slavery in different ways. Barton cited Rush Dooney extensively in that paper. So you can see how his ideas sort of make it through to many of the movement leaders today. So here's some of the things he shares with Christian nationalists today. The idea of the US as a redeemer nation, chosen by God, the idea that it should be an Orthodox Christian republic in which women are subservient to men, he was adamant about that. Education is in the hands of conservative Christians. He hated public schools, that no one pays taxes to support the poor or Black people. And at one point, America deviated horribly from his, he was a terrible racist, by the way. He was a defender of segregation and slavery. I wouldn't say he actively promoted it, but he certainly defended it in really disgusting language.
Do I even want to ask what his thoughts on homosexuals was?
Oh, I mean, he believed that gay people should be stoned. Not just gay people, blasphemers, recalcitrant teenagers. I mean, adulterers. I mean, he really believed in, you know, well, biblical law says these people should be, you know, stoned to death. And therefore, so he was advocating an incredibly strict biblical literalism, very hierarchical. And, you know, he was a very complex character. And again, one could make fun of Rush Dooney, but I actually read about 15 of his books. I sort of went down a Rush Dooney rabbit hole when I was researching my book. He had a very interesting childhood. So he was Arminian. His father ministered at an Arminian church in California. This is during the Arminian genocide when, you know, Arminians were being massacred because they were, you know, when Arminian Christians were being massacred. And he came to feel that there was no neutrality in the world. He said it's either God's law or something much worse. And so he took this idea of the absence of neutrality, and everything is like, it's like either God's way to the letter or it's chaos. He took this throughout his lifetime, this idea. And so that's one of the reasons, I'm sorry to interrupt, for his opposition to public schools, which he called promoting chaos and disintegration into the void. A school that didn't have a very strict interpretation of Christianity as its guiding principle, he saw as promoting chaos.
I want to stick on this point for a second, because I think a lot of people look at this and would say, why are these Christian nationalists so tied to like a form of libertarianism, essentially? You would think that Ayn Rand would not be something that Christian nationalists would like. But from what I can tell, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, it's sort of an alliance of convenience in some ways, because I think the idea is if we weaken the federal government enough and we get state government more and more powerful, we can institute our religious sort of ideas on the state level. I know that's a crude way of saying it. Is that what that alliance with libertarianism is about?
Well, I love your, you know, bringing us back to the idea of sort of states' rights. And this is like, you know, in the run-up to the Civil War, this is the Southern states, you know, this is their argument. They want states' rights because they want to be allowed to continue to enslave people. And the pro-slavery theologians at the time were very much allied with money, with private interests, with property, and a property of other human beings. It's really disgusting. You know, as Frederick Douglass himself noted, that there were abolitionist theologians, but they tended to argue from what he called humble pulpits. And it was the pro-slavery, he said the major, you know, most of the major and well-funded pastors at the time, he said he called them the $5,000 divines. That was considered a lot of money at that time. He said they're on the side of the slaveholder. So let's bring it through to today. You know, I call it an alliance between the proselytizers and the privatizers. I think people don't understand always the degree to which the sort of hyper-conservative religion has been allied with sort of these libertarian economic interests. If we look at figures from the mid-century, like people like James Fifield, who was the founder of an organization called Spiritual Mobilization, he thought, you know, there was a lot of like fear of communism at the time, and he thought that we needed to save America, and the way to do it is through an alliance between hyper-conservative religion and sort of a right-wing or libertarian economic ideology that favors, you know, moneyed interests. So he got funding from like Chrysler and Mobil Oil and Sun Oil and a lot of other big corporate interests to promote this sort of conservative religious philosophy in his, in churches. There was an effort at the time to sort of a real backlash between the sort of conservative religious ideas and the more liberal forms of religion that had taken hold in a lot of the mainline denominations. And so the attack on liberal religion, it's interesting. People see, you know, sometimes if you talk about this, it's an attack on religion. It's not. The religious right has declared an attack on liberal theologies and liberal religions for a very long time, for centuries. I mean, back in the era of emancipation, in my book, The Power Worshippers, I write about a dozen anti-slavery theologians, or abolitionist theologians, Charles Grandison Finney, and the names are Aidan Ballou. I mean, there are a number of them. A lot of these folks were also advocating for women's rights and a sort of a greater role of women, certainly in the church and in society. And so some of their sort of pro-slavery theologians accused them of waging what they called promiscuous assemblies. And they, you know, accused them of, heresy just because they were advocating for the emancipation of Black people and the rights of women. So it's this kind of, you know, there's always been this sort of tension between sort of more liberal forms of religion that emphasize the social gospel, care for the poor, the notion of equality among all citizens, regardless of race and gender, and a more sort of conservative views of religion that are more hierarchical and want sort of more, or, you know, that type of society.
It's interesting you mentioned that, and then I'll wrap up after this point, but I've always heard just through the grapevine that a lot of really religious right or Christian nationalist types are very picky about if their kid wants to go to school for religious reasons, right? Like getting into theology, they're very picky about where they go. They don't want them going to an academic that may teach theology, but is very academic about it. They want them going to Liberty U. Am I misinterpreting that, or is that... is that a thing? Like, they seem to be very, I mean, they have their own educational institutions is what I'm getting at.
That's definitely true. And that's, interesting. You know, I mean, people have a right to have their education institutions. In my view, they don't have a right to a taxpayer subsidy for it. But it's true, there's a kind of hostility within some sections of the movement to certainly to critical thinking, to expertise. I was at a very small New Apostolic Reformation church in West Texas, and the pastor, it was a pretty working class area, and music was amazing. It was actually a lot of fun, you know, speaking in tongues. It was a very sort of free kind of freeing form of worship for a lot of folks. But, the pastor got up there, he gave a very interesting speech. He said, you know, you can get an education, but then you got to gain mastery over your education. He was expressing a deep hostility to the idea of any advanced education for these folks. And I just thought that was really sad, isn't it? You know, But I think you're right. There's kind of a, it's funny, Rushduni, who we were speaking about earlier, that mid-century theologian, he went to Berkeley for college because he was, you know, from California, and that was like a local, you know, public university to go to. He called it the most disturbing experience, most disgusting experience of his life. I'm paraphrasing here, but he was told to read the classics, and I can't remember the term he used, but it was hilarious. It was sort of like, you know, these are like works of, you know, depravity. You know, I think he used the words or depravity to describe the sort of classics that he was instructed to read.
Well, that's an interesting part of the story that I want to conclude on. You mentioned that, you know, you've been to these events, you know, where, you know, you would probably see things like, you know, the speaking in tongues, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I've had people say, well, these people that go to these type of events, they're going to get what they deserve in the end. You know, the working class in America kind of is falling behind, and that's just their fault. How much of the blame, though, should go on these sort of political movements of the Christian right that basically say, like, please stay dumb and stupid so we can control you, or uneducated? I don't know. I shouldn't be so partisan. But I feel bad for the people that get taken advantage of by these leaders, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, the religious right claims to defend the family, but they're endorsing economic policies that are intensive, leading to this. We have a really historic, intensive, you know, stratified society. Let's think about, like, in the 1950s and 1960s. So I was at this Values Voters Conference, and I heard Franklin Graham say, you know, he said, we are nostalgic for the time of America in the 1950s and 60s. And we support Donald Trump because he is nostalgic for that time period too. Okay, so there's a lot to unpack here. Bear with me. Let's think about that. 1950s and 60s, it was legal to discriminate. Racial discrimination was legal, and gender discrimination was legal. It was illegal to be gay. If you were gay, you couldn't be a doctor, a lawyer, or any other number of professions. So there was all that kind of bigotry. But for argument's sake, let's be charitable to Franklin Graham and posit the idea that he's not being nostalgic for that. Maybe he's being nostalgic for the idea of an America where the center still held, you know, where there was more of a, more like, you know, community seemed more sustainable and people had easier lives. Okay, so let's think about what was happening in economic terms in the 1950s. In the 1950s, the average CEO made 20 times what the average worker made. Okay, 20 times, that's pretty great. It means you could have a really nice house and beautiful car and a pool, whatever else you wanted. Maybe you could have a boat, or, you know, you could have a nice lifestyle. 20 times what your average worker made. Let's take us back into 2017. The average CEO makes over 360 times what the average of a Standard & Poor company makes, over 360 times what the average worker makes, and has an average pay packet of over $13 million. So this shows that we have, like, the disparity is incredible. This is going to have real consequences in our society when, you know, when levels of economic inequality become so high and so extreme, and we have a winner-take-all economy. It's destabilizing for all of society. I'm sorry, you were going to say.
Well,
something.
I was just going to say, no, finish your point, and then I wanted to add something there.
Well, yeah, but the religious right is endorsing economic policies that are intensifying economic inequality, and I don't think that benefits anybody. You know, you could say it's the poor who are going to suffer. I think everybody suffers when you have a society where the democracy is no longer sustainable, and you're tipping into autocracy, and you're led by a patently amoral president who doesn't respect the rule of law or the Constitution. A movement that treats the Constitution and the laws enshrined in our founding documents like toilet paper.
Well, yeah, they're always. I guess what I was gonna say is, the way the Christian right portrays itself, I see them in the opposite light. Like, they'll talk about the Constitution, and I will think, yeah, you're the ones that are, you know, really against the Constitution. And I guess I was gonna comment, you know, as Like I said, I sort of had a Catholic upbringing, but I would read people like Dorothy Day and the Catholic Workers Union. So I like very socially conscious type Catholicism. So this stuff to me is like really against my own values, just even on a religious level. And I just cringe when I hear you tell the story of, you know, this pastor saying you have to have mastery over your education. Yeah. It just reeks of this mentality of, you know, we want to control you. Don't go to school. And the whole control of women's bodies with the abortion debate. I mean, is this what we're sort of seeing and getting down to the wire here? Is this what Christian nationalism is about? Is it really just the power worshipers?
It's about, it's, you know, the power worshipers, I called it that sort of like a double meaning. They worship power. They're allied with, you know, a certain type of autocratic, plutocratic power. And they're also an extraordinarily powerful movement. I think people underestimate the power of the movement. I was at one of these Road to Majority conferences, and I heard Ralph Reed speak, and he said, pay no attention to the numbers. He said, pay no attention to the demographic numbers. Like, our numbers are shrinking. All that matters is who turns out on election day. And they know with this disproportionate organizing that they have, if they can sort of turn out their numbers in great enough, their people in great enough numbers. Steve Bannon called them the hobbits and the shire. he said, if you can get the hobbits and the shire out, he said, you turn them out in disproportionate numbers, you can win elections. And that's what we're seeing. So I think that, you know, here's the thing. The reason why the Republican Party has unfortunately become so extreme, so incredibly extreme, is because there are a collection of Republican leaders who see that the only way to win their sort of elections in their gerrymandered districts is by running to the right of their Republican opponents. So they think, well, you know, I can only defeat this person by running to the right of them. And the movement is rewarding them because the movement is an extreme movement. They're not remotely conservative. It's a radical movement. So they're rewarding the sort of hyper-conservatives with the sort of fruits of their machinery. And I think that in this upcoming election, there has to be a defeat, not just a defeat along the margins, but of such landslide proportions that it sends a very clear message to Republican politicians that if you embrace these extreme positions, you're really not going to, you know, you're really outnumbered. They need to read the room. This is not what most Americans want.
You don't think it's going away, though? I mean, this election.
No, I mean, this is a movement that is very determined. It's very long range in its thinking. They know very well that a lot of their policies are extremely unpopular, and that's why they've invested so much in the courts, you know, because if you can, doesn't matter what everybody wants, if you can capture the courts, you can capture the laws, and you can capture the nation.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Ralph Reed. I believe I've read that he said a while back that we need to, the Christians need to render to God and Caesar, or no, render to God and Trump. It sort of played off that line, render unto right. Caesar. I guess in closing, what do you want people to get out of the power worshipers and just your journalism on this subject in general?
I think that we can't meet the challenges we face as a society unless people know exactly what we're up against. So when I wrote The Power Worshippers, you know, I really went inside the machine. I felt like I wanted to get inside the thing, you know, there's a lot of investigative first person reporting there. I take readers all around the country to gatherings and strategy meetings and events. And I really wanted to show how the machinery works. And I really also wanted to show folks what's at stake. You know, I think the question is really, are we going to live in a representative democracy that respects the rule of law and that is governed by, our constitutional principles, which have always been, the idea of a representative democracy has always been applied imperfectly, but it's an ideal to ascribe to. I've been rereading like Federalist Number 10 and the Constitution myself. And there's just some, you know, obviously, you know, we've evolved since some of the early days when there was a disenfranchisement, but there are a lot of ideals in there. They're really beautiful. And this is a, you know, something we should continue to aspire to.
What would you say to the people that are, let's say, I know people that just think the fight's over. They're like, you know, it's going to be like a Handmaid's Tale in 10 years. They took over the courts, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Yeah. Go on. Yeah.
I remain optimistic. You know, I think that, you know, religious right has been using all the tools of democratic political culture to end democracy, but those same resources can be used to restore it.
Well, I think that's a perfect note to end on. And I always love to end on that positive, optimistic note. So I thank you for that. How can my listeners get a hold of the book and keep up with your work?
Great. The book is called The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. It is sold everywhere books are sold, Amazon, independent bookshops, et cetera. And you can follow me on Twitter, Kath S. Stewart. There are two S's in there. And thank you very much.
And thank you for coming on Parallax Use.
It's really great to see you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Catherine Stewart, author of the important book, The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Emilia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, join those listeners in supporting me on Patreon at the $10 or $15 tier at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.